Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a Dhamma talk from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey. If you find benefit from this talk, please support the restoration, the preservation, and the presentation of the Buddha's Dhamma with your donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. So I introduced this briefly. Matt and I had a little meeting last week talking about everything that's going on and coming back in here. And Matt's brilliant. He mentioned this sutta. And I said, yeah, that's the one we got to do on Tuesday. So it's actually two. We did the Loka Sutta and the Ratana Sutta within the last few months, but they're just so appropriate to what's occurring and what has occurred in the last three plus months. So as I read them, just reflect on how close and how similar what's occurring today was to what was occurring during the Buddha's time. And it was the if you remember the Kalama Sutta, that's a sutta where the Buddha is reassuring the people in the city of Asali who are overcome by a plague and other natural disasters. And he told them, first you take to your physical needs like we're doing, and then take to the Dhamma so you can reclaim mm-hmm. your mind. So let me get to the Loka Sutta and then the Ratana Sutta. The Loka Sutta. The newly awakened Siddhartha, now Buddha, was enjoying the peace of release. Established in concentration, he observed the world around him. He noticed human beings aflame with the fires born of the defilements of passion or greed, aversion, and deluded consciousness. Realizing the significance of what he saw, he thought, "The world is aflame, rooted in ignorance. The world is afflicted by sensory contact and perceives suffering as self." Nothing so describes what's occurring as the taking suffering as self. Look at what everybody's screaming about in the world today. It's all rooted in self-referential views. Look what's happening to me, rather than what can I do to reclaim my mind, to reclaim my sanity. That's the Buddha's teaching. Perceive suffering as self, rooted in ignorance. It misunderstands self and becomes anything other than self. That's the most frightening line I've ever met or I've ever read of the Buddha, to become anything other than self. What's the Buddha describing? He's describing wandering around, this is the usual term, wandering endlessly in samsara, which is euphemism for wandering endlessly in ignorance. When we live a life rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, we are anything other than self. We have become anything other than self, according to the Buddha. I believe him. The Buddha continues, becoming anything other than self, the world clings to becoming. It could easily, just as easily, or even maybe a bit more accurately been translated as, becoming anything other than self, the world clings to what they've become. We cling to what we've created of ourselves. Why do we cling so tenaciously to it? Why do we cling so tenaciously to it, Matt? I don't know if you can tell if I'm looking at you or not.
Well,
fear of losing it, right?
Impermanence.
Yeah, it's not quite it. You're all around it.
Well, ignorance of Four Noble Truths.
The world clings to what they have become. We cling to it because we own it. Mm-hmm. We made it, we own it. And that's why it's so hard to let go of all the fabricated views. The Buddha says they're like foam on the ocean, but yet we cling to nothing, don't we?
Could it be, too, that because of the becoming that we identify with what we created?
Yeah, it's the same thing as, yeah, we own it. It's us. That it's self-identification with our own fabrications.
So it's at that point of name and form.
Yes.
You get in trouble.
And yes. And that is the same name and form. What we're talking about is at the point of contact is how we're doing this. And so when the world is really aflame like it is now, there's constant sensory contact with what's occurring. And when our minds are rooted in ignorance, everything that's occurring is self-referential. So those minds start taking extreme views. Extreme views that have nothing to do with reality. There may be a shred of something that's informing the view, but unless the view is recognized as rooted in ignorance, we can never get to a resolution. And that's really the point. We keep playing the same scene over and over again. That's why this sutta is so appropriate, because again, it's exactly what's occurred 2,600 years ago. This is exactly what occurred in my life when I was younger, in my late teens and early 20s. The world was in just this kind of strife. Nothing has changed. Nothing has changed. And that I don't mean to keep saying that over and over again to be melancholy or despondent over what's occurring. Recognizing what is occurring and that it keeps reoccurring because it's rooted in ignorance is the key to escaping that. Not that the Dhamma is an escape. It's a key to understanding. And so the way that we become at peace with anything in the world, including what's occurring right now, is to understand it, not to change it. Not to change it. An understanding of dukkha is an understanding that this is what occurs in a human population that's rooted in ignorance. The best we can do as Dhamma practitioners is to understand it, and then we can be an example for true peace and true radical change, which is what the Buddha brought into the local environment in northern India and southern Nepal during his lifetime. I don't know if I like this way of deal. I think that's Brett, but we lost Lorna. Where'd Lorna go? Becoming anything other than self, the world clings to becoming, is afflicted by becoming, and yet delights in that very becoming. That last line points to conceit or ongoing I make. I made this, I love it. I love what I've made of myself. No matter how much pain it might bring me or other people. When I was living at the bottom of a vodka bottle every day of my life for years and years and years, I was delighted in my life, especially when I got to the liquor store before 9 p.m. That was my goal every day. And I was delighted when I achieved my goal. And we do that with everything. Once we get the object of our desire, for the moment, everything is fine. And I can remember walking into my house. I lived up at Holland Township toward at the end of my addiction. Walking in the door, I had a cheap bottle of vodka, a case of beer, and some kind of cheap whiskey when I got tired of the vodka. And I can still have that feeling now. And I'm relating this because it's such a clear example of how we cling to things. And once we get them, we think everything is okay. And so I'd walk into my front door at 9:30 or 10 o'clock in the morning, just after the liquor store is open. I close the door and I have this feeling like I have just won the lottery. I have everything I need. And I did until it ran out, until something changed. And that's the problem with what we cling to, because it will always change. Whether it's a cheap bottle of vodka or a friend's smile, if we insist on having it in our lives, or the resolution to racial injustice. If we cling to it, our minds remain in that craving state, and there's always stress and tension there. There's never any peace in that mind. And it's always a reactive mind. It's primed to react. And look what's occurred. Yet delight's in that very, very becoming. Where there is delight, there is fear. This is another incredible line. Where there's delight, there's fear. Why?
Because we
know we're going to lose it.
Yeah.
We understand, every human being understands impermanence to their core, but it's the main thing that we ignore. It's the essence of ignorance. Just like when I walked in the door with a bottle of vodka and a case of beer. In that moment, I had everything I needed for the rest of my life, provided I only lived for a couple more hours. The Buddha continues, the life integrated with the Eightfold Path is lived for the abandoning of becoming. Buddha's words, the life integrated with the Eightfold Path is lived for the abandoning of becoming. That's why we're Dhamma practitioners. That's why we integrate the Eightfold Path, so that we can abandon becoming further ignorant in this moment. Those that say that escape from becoming is by non-becoming are never released from becoming, I declare. The Buddha inserts that declaration because he's making a point that this is so important. What is non-becoming? Non-becoming is any speculative self-establishment of the self in any non-physical realm. if you not to beat it up, but it just to makes the point. Most of modern Buddhism, especially Mahayana Buddhism, is engaged in just that type of practice. Finding a way, a repository for a fabricated self as a reward for this life, but in some non-physical realm that is contrary to everything that is human about us. Non-becoming is any establishment in a speculative realm, but it also includes the idea, the practical idea, that I am the best meditation teacher, the best alcoholic, the best acupuncturist, the best this and the best that. Even if it may be an experience of our lives, it's still in our imagination that we are the best of, or that we need to be the best of. That's non-becoming. Even though it's reflected in the outer world, it's in our minds that we're living. It's non-becoming. We may be carrying that non-becoming into the physical world and living that non-becoming state. That's the essence of ignorance. That's wandering in samsara. They are never released from suffering, from becoming, I declare. Stress or dukkha arises in dependence on becoming self, becoming an ignorant self. With the ending of clinging to self and maintaining self, no stress will arise. The key to lasting peace and happiness. Look at the world, the Buddha declares. Human beings afflicted with ignorance crave for and cling to becoming. All forms of becoming anywhere, in any way, are impermanent, stressful, and always subject to change. If I do all these things, if I master the Ten Commandments, I'm going to Christian heaven. If I master the Buddha's Dhamma, I'm going to go to Tulsita heaven. If I say the right chant, I'm going to be going to Abhidhamma heaven, where I'll be taken care of by Abhidhamma Buddha forever and ever and ever. I can't think of something more boring than spend eternity being taken care of by another being. And yet we look at that as reward. In fact, millions, that I just mentioned, I don't want to go too far into that. That's how people live their lives. And whether we do it as a religious projection or just the gold at the end of the rainbow, meaning if I could just keep getting the pile bigger and bigger. And again, we've lived our whole life in that ignorance. We spent a life becoming anything other than what we are, which is human beings.
So isn't it, John, so important, right view, right intention?
Yes.
And even a great practitioner, without that foundation, can just be fooling themselves all the way to a disappointment. With right view and right intention, it sets the foundation of a good practice.
Yes, yes. It right at the beginning of practice is the beginning of the emergence of right view, and it's maintained by the second factor of right intention, which is really just to continue with Dhamma practice, to understand. Thank you, David. That's why we do what we do. And as Dhamma practitioners, we practice the Dhamma. And it's one of the most curious things for me now that I discovered the Buddha's Dhamma and developed to the point where I understand it well enough to teach it. But when I first came across the Buddha's Dhamma, I was still stuck in the modern Buddhist view, and it took me a while to unwind the vested interest I had in the fabrications that I had put so much time in creating for myself, and that's really the problem. But as I started practicing the Buddha's Dhamma and realized pretty early on, once I was studying the suttas, that in order to actually practice what the Buddha taught, I had to let go of all the rest of that stuff. And that one thing, that one decision, changed my whole life. To let go of all the things that I put my entire life's effort into understanding, throw it out the window, and focus on this one thing. And it worked. Wow. I think it's loud, isn't it? I guess I can turn that down. The Buddha's words, knowing this, the arising and the passing away, from right view, craving for becoming and non-becoming is abandoned. From right view. How do we develop right view? Through the Eightfold Path. From the abandonment of craving for becoming and non-becoming comes unbinding. For those unbound from lack of clinging to fabricated views, clinging and maintaining those fabricated views, there is no further becoming. I'm kind of botching this up, so let me go back to it. From the abandonment of craving for becoming and non-becoming comes unbinding. For those unbound from lack of clinging and maintaining, there is no further becoming. We're awakened human beings. They have conquered ignorance. They have completed the task and have gone beyond becoming. And I would say gone beyond even the shred of becoming further ignorant, which is a self-rooted in ignorance. That's the end of that sutta. I was going to read the Ratana Sutta, but I think this sutta kind of says it all, doesn't it? And we covered the Ratana Sutta. So let's leave it there. A part of this class included a poem called If by Rudyard Kipling. And I'd like to use that to close the class as opposed to meta. Just this once. I think that'll be appropriate. So let's go online first and see what our online folks have to say. Hello, Lorna.
Hello, John. I'm afraid I had some technical difficulty, and I've been in and out of your meeting, and you've just frozen on the screen and all that sort of stuff. Oh. So I haven't actually heard it.
It's the most brilliant talk I ever gave, too.
I'm sure it is. I've got about a tenth of it, and it was all in pieces and stuff like that. So I'll sit on my cushion today. Thank you.
Well, what'd you think of that 1/10?
I thought you were brilliant.
I'll post it later tonight. Thanks,
all right,
Lana.
Thank you.
Sarah, how are you tonight?
Feeling very rooted and ignorant.
Yeah, but you're working on it.
I'm working on it.
Yeah. Are you still in Maine? You got another couple weeks, right?
Yeah, I'm on the
4th. Ah, great. On July 4th?
Yes.
Independence Day, that's great.
Wow.
Yeah. Do you have anything you'd like to comment on this sutta?
Yeah, I mean, it was hitting me where I'm at right now.
Yeah.
It explains a lot of my trouble.
All of our troubles. Well, excuse me. I'm glad you joined us tonight, Sarah. I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you, yeah.
How are you, Kevin? Is that
Kevin? Hi, John. This is here.
How are you tonight?
Doing well. Appreciate giving this talk at this time. It's a very comprehensive sutta. I think that this is one of those suttas that could the whole Dhamma resides here as well. I think a lot of people would understand that, and really appreciate the timeliness of teaching this. Really means a lot. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us tonight. Ram, how are you?
I'm good. Yeah, this was a good another diving into this becoming that he talks so often. And he takes it right from ignorance to our becoming in the world, how we are becoming something other than self.
Yeah.
And just can't read this enough. Because he pounds on this word so often, becoming.
Yeah.
And you can spend hours just contemplating this part of the teaching.
Yeah.
Because it's easy to go astray here. But this sort of lays it out very, very, very carefully.
Yeah.
in detail. And I could read it for another half dozen times and keep finding things in it
that, yeah,
where we can use this in daily life to understand when we are becoming.
Yeah.
And the sneaky ways that we try to do this becoming and not becoming, you know, any excuse to not be where we are, to become something else, somewhere else.
Yep.
So thank you for throwing this one in here again and having us look at it.
You're welcome. Thank you for your comments. The the whole point of the Buddha's Dhamma is, what am I becoming in this moment? Not what's happening to me, not what the world is making me become. What am I becoming? Because we only have one choice all the time, in each and every moment. You know, am I going to become further ignorant? Or am I going to use this moment to become Buddha, to become awakened? That Buddha means awakened. So in this moment, we can either become Buddha or we can become further ignorant. That's it. There is no other choice for Dhamma practitioners. Some people would say that's too simplistic, but that is just it. We can either be awakened human beings, be Buddhas, or we can live our lives in ignorance. And there's nothing wrong with people that choose to live their lives in ignorance. I'd rather not, though. Jane, how are you?
And thank you for bringing up Rudyard Kipling's...
I got a little story about that, too, but yeah. Hi, Jane.
Hi, John. Thank you for this very appropriate teaching. I miss everybody online, but the fact that you're there means we're going in the right direction, so...
Yeah.
It's all good.
It's all good. Thank you for joining us tonight. How are you, my friend?
John, good to see you. Good to see everybody here in this room. Good to be here with everybody. Something that keeps coming up in the sutta, there's two things that I want to touch on. One is self. And when the Buddha, in other suttas, in fact, in a talk that I gave in the spring retreat, the Buddha says, is form self? Are feelings the self? Are perceptions the self? Are fabrications the self? Is consciousness the self? The refrain was, no. Is form permanent? No. Are feelings permanent? No. Is perception permanent? No. Are mental fabrications permanent? No. Is consciousness permanent? No. So self can't be form, feelings, perceptions, mental fabrications, or consciousness. So what is this becoming? Craving establishes, clinging maintains, dukkha. So becoming is dukkha. It's stressful.
Yep.
It's suffering.
Outstanding. Matt just gave us a preview of Saturday's class in the Anattalakana Sutta. Tim, how are you tonight?
Very well. Hello, everybody. Good to see you. Everybody else? Everybody online, hello. I just love this poem.
Well, I'm sorry, Tim. I've been meaning to ask, is anybody too cold? We're okay with
the
temperature?
I think David might be.
Because if anybody's cold, let's turn the air conditioning down or off. Is it? Or if we're okay, we're okay.
I'm fine.
Okay.
John,
sorry.
I just want to let you know I'm good with the temperature.
All right. Very good, sir. Who said you're not awakening? Sorry, Tim.
That's all right. I really love this poem. This poem was really resonated with me. I know we're gonna go. You're gonna go over. I just wanted to mention that. But he hasn't read it. Just
it really is a great poem.
Absolutely fantastic. And really touches upon so many things that we deal with in learning about and practicing the Dhamma.
Yeah, it's remarkable, Matt.
To what Matt said, thank you, Matt. You know, we'll have to talk some other time. I don't want to get too much into it, but, you know, the self, anatta, you know, I've been struggling with the two or three minds in one mind in recognizing itself, anatta, conscious, the three dependent origination of the self. The unconscious, which we fall asleep in, the mind still allows us to breathe and regulate hormones and temperature and brain activity. We have no control over, but there is still control. And then there's that subconscious. There's that part that is locked in the closet because it behaves so badly. And I guess it depends on your personality type. I don't know. I'm not an expert on it. But there's a struggle of when practicing the Dhamma and reading these suttas of clarity in the, on the conscious level. And then there's this resistance. And that's where that acceptance comes in. And it seems like there's a struggle and a fight. And not enough for everybody, and it probably takes a lot of practice. And this is why I always feel like it's easy to understand, it's hard to accept. And I mean that on the subconscious level. The conscious level, I can accept things. But yet, here we all are, on a daily basis, struggling in life sometimes, and having dukkha, and going through dependent origination, and having rebirth, and becoming.
Mm-hmm.
It's because of that conflict, that inner conflict that exists. These suttas resonate because the Buddha so correctly points to the root cause of that conflict.
Yep.
And one of these days I'm going to wake up and I'm just going to get it and not have that inner conflict when it comes to the Dhamma.
Mm-hmm.
As much as I think I can articulate right now with it, I think you know where I'm going with
it. I do,
yeah.
But
thank you for the sutta. The sutta is definitely one that's apropos for what's happening now.
Yeah. That's pretty much it. Thank you, Tim. I mean, you bring up some important points that are also reflected in modernity is what I'm trying to say. Subconscious, unconscious, and superconscious are all modern phrases. That's not to say that people 2,600 years ago didn't have a subconscious and an unconscious. Superconscious is a New Age fabrication. And so the parts of our thinking that are not, that we have not, we that are reactive within us, are fabrications. They are rooted in ignorance. They're only those aspects of our unconscious or subconscious are what is maintained though by ignorance. So the practical Dhamma is not to be, it avoids trying to figure out what's going on there, and puts our mind and our body in what's occurring. And so in this moment, whether you believe in past lives, going back zillions of years, or just this one life, in this moment, at any point in a human being's life, is a culmination of all their experiences. That's why if we're going to change anything about ourselves, we have to be in the present moment. And so in this present moment, I've brought my subconscious, my unconscious, and if I have a superconscious, I brought it into this moment. And with the framework of the Dhamma, I can address it. I can address the quality of my mind directly. And that's the key. That's the resolution for conflict within myself. You often hear me present it. If I want to end conflict in the world, I have to first end that conflict that you described in myself. And that conflict, I'm really glad you brought this up. The conflict is not rooted in obviousness. The conflict is rooted in our subconscious and our unconscious. So that's an important, I mean, really great insight there, Tim. Thank you. David, how are you tonight?
Thank you. Our friend Matt used a word just before we started referring to Laura. He used the word steep. She's steeped in the practice. She's steeped in the Dhamma. And I truly believe that with a diligent practice, your mind starts changing.
Yep.
And that flow of consciousness that you don't control starts changing. I just believe that it does change, and that the way you sit in that moment of ease, you see dependent origination, and you see contact, and you see that I consciousness, and you see that you don't have to react the way you used to react, and you don't have to cling to those aggregates that are just there all the time.
Yep.
And that's what that practice is. That's what this sangha is, because you get to see everyone at different levels, and they're all heading in the same direction. So I'm always very encouraged by people's struggles and people's momentary successes, and that's why it's part of the, you know, three jewels. So thank you.
Yeah. Well said, David. Thank you. Matt, remind me about next Tuesday. I want to keep the class going.
Yeah.
So just I want to make the announcement. Thank you. Hello, Michael.
Hi, John. Hi, everybody. I like the concept of, and I think without doubt, without right view, nothing goes as it should unless we have right view.
Yeah.
We might even think that we're on the right path, but if we don't have right view established, and we don't know how to get to that point of right view, then we're, I don't know if we're truly practicing the Dhamma as it was intended by the Buddha. So, for me, and as it says down here, actually, John, at the beginning of the sutta, knowing this, the arising and passing away from right view, right before becoming and non-becoming is abandoned. From right view. But we have to understand what right view is. And we need a profound understanding of right view. The profound understanding of right view, again, is always seen through our understanding of impermanence and the three marks of existence. And that's something that I truly believe in. I believe that's the discernible truth there in a relationship as to how to cultivate right view. And from that right view, obviously, we can now, and we hold, with refined mindfulness, we hold the Eightfold Path in the forefront of our mind, right? We hold it in mind, moment by moment, as life unfolds. The Eightfold Path is embedded in our mind, cultivated, so to say.
Yep.
Our response, then, from profound right view in relation to the impermanent world and to the individuals who, such as ourselves, are existing here, is we have an understanding of where we are in relation to that world, in relation to what's most important now, once we start understanding that, is to understand, okay, so we know that the ego self, we know that the self that we identify with, we know that this is anatta, this is the not self. But how do we get to how do we rid ourselves of the ego self? And that's not a simple thing to do, obviously, because if it was simple, then we'd all be enlightened. So from there, we have to, through right view and profound understanding of that, understand that, like, we have to be selfless. We have to become selfless. We have to understand compassion. So when we hold the Eightfold Path in mind, in reaction to anything and everything that occurs in our lives, moment by moment as life unfolds, we will be approaching our journey, our path, our journey, or staying on our path and our journey by being compassionate in a manner that we are selfless. Compassion is a selfless act. So as compassion is a selfless act, we are now separating ourselves from the ego self, and the unbinding is beginning. We start to unbind at that point, I believe.
That's the Dhamma. Thank you. I'll ask the group because I don't want to put anybody on the spot. Who can tell me the Buddha's description of right view? It's very simple and very basic. Who knows? Anybody?
That I'm ignorant, but I want to learn.
The Buddha teaches, yes. The Buddha teaches that right view is knowing stress. Right view is knowing the cause of stress, craving for and clinging to ignorant views. Right view is experiencing the cessation of stress. Right view is knowing and experiencing the path to the cessation of stress. Mm-hmm. Right view relates directly to the Four Noble Truths. Mm-hmm. And that's all right view is. Of course, it's a pretty profound right view once mm-hmm. you develop it. So the only thing that I would argue with you, Michael, is that the Eightfold Path is an incredibly simple path, but it's made complicated by clinging and maintaining. That's what we're coming up against. The fabrications that arise for us to recognize and abandon are there because in this moment I'm clinging. And when I recognize it and abandon it, I'm no longer clinging, just like it says in the sutta. So it does seem very complicated, and for many of us it seems almost, at times, almost impossible. But like the Buddha says, it's like foam on the ocean. The things we're holding on to are there because we're holding on to it. There's no other power that our thoughts or our feelings have except the power that we give it. We give it all the power. That's why the proper meditation and understanding Four Foundations of Mindfulness is so important, because it tells us that our feelings and our thoughts, those things that we're so enamored with, the things that we use to keep creating a self, are meaningless. Julia, how are you? You have your hand up, Michael?
One more point. Last time we had met, we had discussed this, and I think this is a very important thing to. I think it basically is the main theme in the Dhamma. And we had spoken about civil unrest and everything, and actually you brought this up and very nicely put forth by you, and you. We were talking about perspective, and we were also talking about compassion in in relation to. And I don't want to get into the whole thing about what's going on in the world right now, but you had mentioned that and this actually shows true understanding of compassion, And I was very impressed by this. When you had come out and said this, but you also. You showed at that point that, yes, you understand completely exactly what compassion is. And in order for you, and the time I'm talking about, the last class we had, right? When you said that, we also have to show compassion for, Mr. Floyd, who died that day, and also for the officer, Chauvin, we have to show compassion. How difficult is it to wrap your mind around that, to show compassion for someone who created or was the cause of such an act? Now, that is actually, in order to do that, you have to be selfless.
Yeah.
Because your ego self will arise in your ego self. And this is obviously, and this is understanding ignorance also. Such anger would arise in the ego self to want to strike out and harm someone like that, or harm individuals who represent what he does. So, but that is the nature of this compassion. It's abandonment, and it's the passing away and abandonment, or creates the passing away and the abandonment of the ego self, which is critical to purifying mind.
Thank you, Mike. Yeah, and to bring that up, I guess I should remind myself, how I guess it's a pretty radical statement to say that we have to, if we're going to be compassionate for George Floyd, we have to be compassionate for Mr. Chauvin. To me, I can't see any other way to live in the world. Just because the act was brutal, we have to understand, where did that brutality come from? And if we don't want to look at it, we should tell ourselves that I'm not looking at it because I insist on continuing to ignore my own ignorance, because that's what it is. And if we really want to change the world, if we really want peace, we got to do something that Rodney King said. Nobody ever gave an answer to that question. Why can't we all get along? Because of ignorance. That's why. And nothing has changed. Again, that's the whole point of all this. If we really, there's millions and millions of sincere human beings that want peace. They want the end of all this rottenness that's going on in the world. But they don't know how to do it. And so they keep doing it. They keep feeding the flames of passion. But we are so fortunate. And I'm not saying that should change. It can change. But we should recognize how fortunate we are to know how not to get caught up. Get it, the word is to be entangled in all that. We don't have to do that. And we can be true beacons of light in that way because we're not contributing to all that anymore. Julia, how are you tonight?
Oh, hi, John. Hi, everybody. You want someone? Who is it? Yeah, I like the poem. This poem, my father, he used to recite it to me often when I was a little girl. Because he used to say that this was like how you should live life.
Yeah.
To this day, if I asked him, he's 82 years old, Pops would, remember that poem, and he would go through the poem. Like, he memorized it, I guess, when he was young, and it just was something that, he always told us. So when I saw the poem, I was like, oh, wow, that's the same poem my father used to always tell me. I like the poem a lot because there's a couple of lines in here that really, when it says, if you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs, that's perfect. I mean, exactly. Yeah. That's a line in equanimity, and that's exactly what we need right now in this time, And then the other is, if you can meet triumph and disaster and treat those two impostures as the same, dispassion, right? It's obvious, And if you can walk with crowds and keep your virtue, of course, naturally, that's the equal path right there. See? Right speech, right action, right effort. So I really like reading it now that I have this different view. Now that I understand the Buddhist Dhamma, now reading this poem has completely different, more meaning,
Oh, yeah.
It's very, very, very nice. And then with the Loka Sutta, there's a paragraph in here that was really, that I think is exactly what the world is right now. It says, look at the world. Human beings afflicted with ignorance and crave for and cling to becoming. All forms of becoming, anywhere and in any way, are impermanent, stressful, and always subject to change. Knowing this, the arising, the passing away from right view, craving for becoming and non-becoming is abandoned. So knowing this, of course, knowing that everything is impermanent, knowing that it arises and passes away, that's the three marks of existence, of course, and knowing that, then from right view, then we can stop our craving and clinging to becoming that way. We can actually meet triumph and disaster and treat them the same and dispassionately, and stop ourselves from becoming further ignorant. I find that passage right there is very strong. And sometimes it does feel like, I feel like sometimes when I'm walking through stressful situations, I feel like there's like I'm walking through a tunnel. As long as I keep myself centered and, taking my breath, keeping my mind in equanimity, I feel like it's like you're walking through a wall of fire, where everything all around you is, burning up, but you can walk through it without being harmed in any way. It's a good feeling, when you have the Dhamma.
Yeah, it is.
To walk through these times, especially. A week ago, I was sitting down for the first time. The teachers, they had a meeting. Of course, we all wore masks and sitting 6 feet apart. And people were very emotional about everything, and they were, everyone was talking about all these different things. And I sat there, taking my breath and trying not to get so because some of the people were very inflamed with all the things that were going on in the world. And I thought, I was very thankful that I had the Dhamma, at that particular moment, because you could see that everyone's caught up in everything that's going around.
Yeah, and yet you were still involved in what was occurring. It's not like you weren't ignorant of what was occurring in the world. You just didn't lose your mind over it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And we were asked to make we had to make you know, pick a word. I have to tell about the serenity. We had to pick a word. We had to put on a plaque where all the teachers were giving, and they said, take this word you're going to take with you for the coming next year. What word would you pick? So I picked serenity. And
good word.
Because I said it's important for us to keep our heads about us. If we're going to teach children, how are you supposed to teach children, make them feel comfortable with the way the world is right now, if you can't embody serenity yourself? You have to at least give that to the children so that they can have peace, you know, within themselves. So that people are like, well, that's good. That's a good word.
It
worked.
It worked. Thank you, Julia.
And thank you, John.
Kate, it's good to see you again.
Good to be back. I read this last night, and I didn't quite get it, and I think what I've taken out of just listening tonight is that for me, the way to peace is to just be.
Yeah.
I have glimpses of that. You know, I'm working from home, and so I'm still drawing a salary. I'm very grateful for that. And I'm not spending any kind of money because I'm not going anywhere.
That's right, yeah.
It's awesome.
Your classes are $200 now, though, you understand?
Oh, yeah, okay. Free class.
Free class.
But I have a lot of moments of peace. And while I'm listening to everybody, I get those moments of peace when I just be.
Yeah.
I don't think. I don't. And what you said about all of the experiences that we have make us who we are. But I can find peace despite all that.
Well, isn't that remarkable?
I had a conversation with another therapist a while ago. I have a pretty severe trauma history, and she was asking me about that, and I said, it really doesn't matter anymore. It just doesn't matter anymore. Mm-hmm. It happened, and it doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
So, that concept and the just sitting on my porch, just being on my porch, is very peaceful. So, I will go home and read this again. Because this seems like a really big intellectual challenge for me.
It does seem like that, especially in the beginning. But it's really not, only because you can only recognize and abandon ignorance as it arises. So we all put our time in. I mean, this is Dhamma practice. What you're doing here is part of Dhamma practice. While you're meditating at home, it's part of Dhamma practice. And as you're reading the suttas and learning them more and more, that's all part of Dhamma practice. And at some point, like Tim just said, it just starts all making sense to you.
Mm-hmm.
But I had a student on the West Coast in L.A. who's been studying for a while. And I didn't ask him if I could. I got to be careful how I say this because I didn't ask for permission to talk about it. Let me just classify it this way. They were having difficulty in integrating some slightly different words than they were used to, and was requesting new venture, more of an explanation that would have been skillful. Because as a teacher, what I told him is, I can explain to you what the word means, but that's just the concept. What I wanted him to do, what I hope we're all doing, we are doing it, is to actually have the experience of learning what jhana means, what mindfulness means, what five clinging aggregates mean. Because I could have a class just on I could have a Dhamma glossary class twice a week, just describing what these words mean. But that's meaningless, isn't it? So the Buddha taught, and I hope I do a decent job of following his lead, the Buddha taught a Dhamma that is to be experienced, not explained. And you're getting that. The notion that when I'm just being is when I'm most peaceful, that's when there's no, you didn't bring any Kate into that, did you? You're just who Kate is.
It's not me, it's just an essence. I don't even know what it is, but it's
well, it's
not.
You as a human being is what it is, without the embellishment of the things that we think we should be or want to be or could be. It's just what I am in this moment. And if we're truly present in that way, the peace has to prevail because there's no ignorance there. Mm-hmm. Sister, I'm so glad you joined us. Yes.
It sounds like a calm and peaceful mind you're not allowing distractions to take away from your equanimity.
Yeah.
That's maintaining the mind united with the body.
Yeah.
And that's where in peace dwells, right, John?
That's it. Only.
One thing you always
only.
Say, or the thing that the first thing that I was taught in Dhamma practice was be gentle with yourself.
Be gentle with yourself, yeah.
And that,
I'm glad you remember that.
That is forgiveness of anything you did in the past that you think you did wrong or whatever it was. Or it just don't, just everybody be gentle with themselves, be gentle with others.
Imagine
and
that.
That's just such a liberating, if you can truly integrate that.
Imagine, I mean, that one thing would change the world, isn't it? But
yeah.
but it's a cruel thing to tell people to be gentle with yourself when you know they can't be.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I wouldn't walk up to somebody on the street and say, you know, your problem is you're not gentle with yourself. They might end up blowing their brains out when they realize they can't be. I say it in here because with the Dhamma, we learn to be gentle with ourselves. It's part of the Dhamma to be gentle. And you mentioned something about forgiveness. Forgiveness isn't something like, well, I recognize how screwed up I used to be, but I'll let myself go.
Mm-hmm.
Forgiveness is the release of any judgment. That's true forgiveness. In fact, I wouldn't say it's true forgiveness. It's the only kind of forgiveness is removing or abandoning the judgment. And that judgment first, if we're going to release judgment of the world, we first have to release it from ourselves. If we're going to end hatred of others, we first have to stop hating ourselves by living the fabrication. That's the essence of the Dhamma.
That's right view. That's the origin of right view.
I think this was the right class for the time.
Yeah.
And Saturdays was too. If you didn't listen to Saturdays or read the articles, please do so because they are brilliant writing and they relate very well to what's occurring. Our friend Larry Carlson, many of you know who Larry is. Larry was on a retreat a couple of years ago, and he joined us about a year ago on a Tuesday night. He's coming out again next Tuesday for a class, and we're going to Bamboo House, who have outside, you know, dining. So if you'd like to go, just please let me know either tonight or by an email, just so I can tell Kara about how many seats we'll need. But I think it's going to be fun. You know, could I get out and we can social distance, but eat some good food. So, who thinks they might be going?
So I don't understand what's going to happen next Tuesday. Are we not meeting here? We're meeting at the Bamboo House.
Yes, we're going to.
Outside.
Yes, we're going, and it's going to be like between 5:15 and 5:30.
Okay.
And then we'll come back here and have a class.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I hope you can join us.
I can't do that, but I can be here.
Okay, we will have a class
okay.
Next Tuesday, too. Okay. Who put their hands up? 1, 2, 3? If you decide to come, just let me know.
Yes,
okay, good. And then this poem by Rudyard Kipling, I got to tell a little bit of a story behind it. I read Kipling in high school in my early 20s and while I was drinking and drugging and getting very impressed by Rudyard Kipling. But when I was putting this class together, it wasn't my memory of reading Kipling, it was my memory of Dennis Hopper reading Kipling. which was, and it, the emotion, it was in a documentary, I can't remember his name, I think it was a German documentary made right after he died, but if you get a chance, do it. The movie's not well made, but that scene is worth going through the whole movie to see Dennis Hopper read this poem. I think Dennis Hopper was our greatest actor. Sorry, Marlon, but... If, by Rudyard Kipling. If you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you, if you can trust yourself when all men doubt you, but make allowance for their doubting too. I love that. If you can wait and not be tired by waiting or being lied about, don't deal in lies. Having trouble reading? Or being hated. Don't give way to hating. And yet, don't look too good, nor look too wise. I work on that all the time. If you can dream and not make dreams your master, if you can think and not make thoughts your aim, that's the essence of the Dhamma, isn't it? If you can meet with triumph and disaster and treat those two imposters just the same. If you can bear to hear the truth you've spoken, twisted by knaves to make a trap for fools, or watch the things you gave your life to, broken, and stoop and bind them, build them up with worn-out tools. If you can make one heap of all your winnings and risk it on one turn of pitch and toss and lose and start again at your beginnings. And never breed a word about your loss. Oh, woe is me. If you can force your heart and nerve and sinew to serve your turn long after they are gone, and so hold on when there is nothing in you except the will which says to them, hold on. If you can talk with crowds and keep your virtue, or walk with kings, nor lose the common touch. If neither foes nor loving friends can hurt you, if all men count with you, but none too much, if you can fill the unforgiving minute with 60 seconds worth of distance run, yours is the earth and everything that is in it, and which is more, I should say, I read this right, and which is more, you'll be a human, my friend. A wonderful poem, isn't it?
Yep.
You'll be a human, my friend. It's so close to the Dhamma. It's the whole point of the Dhamma is becoming a human being, isn't it? So thank you all for joining online, and thank you for a wonderful class. We'll see some of you on Saturday. And nice start coming back, isn't it?
Good to be back.
Very good.
Good to be back.
Thank you, everyone. Take care, everyone. See you soon.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support the continued restoration, preservation, and presentation of the Buddha's Dhamma. If you find benefit here, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.